The starting point to the brand was actually really focusing on what is going to make this product special and meaningful. And that commitment to direct consumer, I think, was at the heart of building a brand of substance. Quality, not quantity, starting small, hand-to-hand combat. And so much has happened since then, and we'll talk about it, but I think that as a central decision gave us that platform. It doesn't matter how good your product is if you do not treat that product as if it's as good as you know it to be.
Hi everyone, welcome to this episode of the Make It Happen show. I'm Tim Morris, the CEO of The Entourage, and today I'm joined by Matt Jones, co-founder and brand director of Four Pillars Gin. Now, if you don't know Four Pillars, it is Australia's best gin. They've won awards around the world, and they're really leading the charge in the craft spirits industry, both here and abroad. And so in this episode, we dive really deep into brand and experience and product excellence. And it's a slightly longer conversation than normal because Matt just has so much to share in this space. And what I loved seeing was just how enthusiastic he is about brand, product experience, and how you really see that show through Four Pillars, through their products, through the experience they give customers. And there's a lot here I think we can all take away and apply to our businesses. So if you've got a business that maybe has a fantastic product, but you're not connecting with customers the way that you want, or you really want people to experience what you do in a better, more meaningful way, this is the episode for you. Let's get into it. Matt Jones, fantastic to have you on the show. How are you?
Tim, I'm well. It is Friday afternoon. Another week of homeschooling that I promised myself I wouldn't talk about is nearly coming to an end. I'm ready for the weekend, which is just like the week, but with less Zoom and less homeschooling. So all is good.
It's like the elephant, the grade four elephant in the room.
Exactly right.
Well, it's awesome to have you on. I'm a big fan of Four Pillars. So I'm really looking forward to diving into like, you know, the brand story, the business story, you know, everything we want to dig into. So to kick us off, you're the brains behind the brand of the business, and you've helped make it Australia's favorite gin. What are some of the secrets to making that happen?
First of all, those were all really nice words you said, and I just want to sit with them. Look, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like Four Pillars has got three co-founders. If anyone's ever seen a photo of the three of us together, they will see that diversity amongst the leadership group is not one of our strong points. It's three pretty much interchangeable, bald, middle-aged white blokes. But we're all quite diverse in, I guess, what we have brought to the Four Pillars journey. And I certainly wouldn't say I'm the brains, but it was once said that Cameron makes gin, Stu makes noise, and I make sense. And I think that's probably a good summation of, you know, you've got three blokes who've all got quite rich backgrounds in the case of Cameron and Stu, and wine production, wine writing and judging. So real expertise in the drinks industry, with me more of a background in brand experience and brand strategy. But we all came to Four Pillars with lots of ideas and lots of energy and lots of thought. But I guess over time, the things that I've championed have probably been a bit more the making sense of it. What is the plan? How is this business going to go from being a pipe dream and something kind of quite fun and almost like a play business on the side and give it its best chance of success? And I guess from a brand point of view, I've really championed the importance of emotions, aesthetics, experiences, that idea that I just wouldn't have been interested in getting involved in a business where I felt the craft wouldn't be differentiated. Just unpack that. Like I wouldn't have been interested in getting involved in the business where I thought that fundamentally we weren't going to make a better product. But I've always believed that making a better product is just really that starting point. It's that platform that then the brand still has to stand up. The brand still has to go, well, how do we get credit for the betterness? Like, you know, we can know that the gin is exceptional and the craft that goes into the gin and the stills and the botanicals, and we can talk a little about that in a minute. We can know all of that. How do we make people feel that? And I guess over the last, 8-9 years, that's always been my real focus through imagery and storytelling and experiences and filmmaking and packaging and brand design and choice of fonts. How in every little touch point and choice have we reflected those same values that we know are inherent in the gin? So, you know, I'm not sure I'm the brains behind it, but I've been the person who's most loudly championed that side of, I guess, the success we've had to date.
Yeah. Well, I love that because making a fantastic product is a very, very honorable pursuit, but it needs to be heard. Like, people need to know about it. People need to experience it in order for it to really shine. How have you built the brand story around Four Pillars? I mean, we obviously see it everywhere. You've got the experiential centers, but like, what are the big building blocks to building that up?
Oh, what a question. I suppose it's probably useful to reflect on what we have done and then almost like pull the little bits of theory from there. I guess, you know, you go back to 2012, 2013, I don't think lots of people in Australia, whether it was in Australian homes or in Australian bars or in Australian retail stores, I don't think lots of people were sitting around going, if only there were more world-class Australian gins. I don't think that was a gap that people felt in their lives. And so, you know, when we came along, I think we had to be really thoughtful about, why are we going to matter? What is it about making gin in Australia that is special? And the thing that we got really excited about was not making gin in Australia, but making Australian gin. Mm. Like, making gin that really expressed not just the identity of Australia and the sense of joy and humor and irreverence and warmth and generosity and all of those things you associate with Australia and Australians, but also taking advantage of the fact that this is the most delicious place on earth. There is nowhere that tastes as good. I mean, you and I both live in Sydney. Four Pillars is based in the Yarra Valley, just outside of Melbourne. You couldn't find two more delicious cities on the planet. Like, that combination of produce, food cultures, diversity. I mean, we're so blessed. We can do so many things here, and we can find so much flavor and color and drinkability. And so I guess the starting point to the brand was actually really focusing on what is going to make this product special and meaningful. The second piece was then going, the more time we have with you, whether it's with you, Tim, or anyone else, the more we can convince you of that. And we have more time when we go direct. So before we'd even landed our still, we decided we had to have the world's best gin still. We had to go to Christian Karl of Germany, get an all copper, beautiful Rolls-Royce gin making machine. And before she'd even landed, we named her Wilma after Cameron's late mum. Before we even had Wilma, we'd already launched our campaign on Possible on a crowdfunding platform. We'd already found the first 300 people who wanted to be part of this story, who were deeply engaged. And that commitment to direct consumer, I think, was at the heart of building a brand of substance. Quality, not quantity, starting small, hand-to-hand combat. And so much has happened since then, and we'll talk about it. But I think that as a central decision gave us that platform.
Yeah. Well, I haven't told you this yet, but I actually had one of those first 300 bottles from that Possible campaign. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Possible and crowdfunding, and had met those guys all those years ago, and I was on there and I saw it. I had a birthday coming up, and I sent it to my wife. I said, this is what I want for my birthday. So one of those first 300 bottles. I would love to say I still have it sitting on the shelf, but it's long drunk and long gone.
Oh, well, that is just sensational. And the stars are all aligned. But look, I mean, that was critical because, you know, it did a couple of things, right? One, it got, you know, 300, 400 people on our side with a little vested interest in seeing this little Australian startup go well. But what it also did was it baked in some ways of being for the brand that have not changed. This love of community, this love of long-form storytelling, this ability to send little gin love letters to people saying, hey, you've supported us. This is what's going on. And thanks to your support, this is what we've made next. And this is what we're launching next. And I think, in a parallel universe, there's a gin brand, I don't know what it's called, like Five Planks, and it goes straight into retail on day one, and it gets used to having this very distant transactional relationship with its customer. And of course, over time, you know, we've been very lucky with the support from the guys at Dan Murphy's and the guys across both the Endeavor Drinks Group, the Coles Liquor Group, and Independence. We've been really fortunate with the support we've had from retailers, from bartenders, but we've never lost that passion for that deep, direct connection. We've never just sort of kind of thrown our hands up and go, we give up. It's like we've always believed that our brand can matter to people. And it might not be a huge number of people, but it can be a growing number of people over time. You know, we just released a a very limited edition product, which was a one-off single vineyard expression of our bloody Shiraz gin. We were able to make about 2,000 bottles of it. It was just this beautiful limited product. It entirely sold out on our website during the pre-release phase. It's going to be a little bit heading out into the world in the next few weeks, but it's super limited. And what I've been loving seeing is we put it in a nice box and as people get it home and they're so excited to open the box and see this product, and the color's just incredible. And as they take the bottle out, there's a little pack of cards that sits hidden under the bottle, and it's just full of storytelling about Cameron's relationship with Yarra Yering and the vineyard and the drink. And there's always more opportunity. There's always more opportunity to go deeper in that story. And you know that only so many people will get that bottle ever and will read that and share it. But for those people, there's connection, there's depth. And I think, you know, what Possible really did was bake that in from day one, that belief in storytelling, that belief in experiences, and that belief in building a really connected community.
Yeah, yeah, because you can definitely see how you carry that all the way through now with the Yarra Valley site, with the one here in Sydney as well, which is all, I went to one of the tastings there not long ago. It is about that experience. You touched on there also the specialty gins. And so that has been it's been a key part of Four Pillars for a long time. Like I think the first I saw of it was the Christmas gins, but now there's the one you just mentioned. I've got one of the olive leaf ones as well. Like where did that idea come from? Because it's super smart, right? It's constant iteration and variation on the core product.
Look, that's exactly right. And it comes from, I guess, one place and one time. So we were fortunate that we had some natural moments when we had to slow down. And one of those moments came when Stu and Cam went on a little fact-finding mission. For those people on the podcast, I am doing air quotes around fact-finding. But look, they went to the US and they drove a convertible BMW all the way from Seattle down to Los Angeles. They visited about 35 gin distilleries and distilleries of all kinds. They tasted everything. And they came back like full of energy around gin style. Like, we can make Australian gin. And I've talked about that. They were really excited about, we have to have this still from Christian Karl of Germany. And the guys at Karl, they've made stills pretty much the same way for 100 years. They are handmade. They don't make them fast. They don't make them cheap. And so from that decision that we had to have a Karl still to Wilma actually being operational in the Yarra Valley was the best part of a year. So you have this natural delay. And yes, we were able to run the Possible campaign, but the other thing we could do was just reflect on purpose. And we said, you know, we sort of took a lead from ideas all of us had about Australia. And you've heard me bang on about, you know, Australia being the world's most delicious place. But we said, look, we're only going to do justice to that if we get up every day absolutely committed to elevating the craft of distilling gin. So the number one thing that went on our little list of purpose, the little hierarchy of purpose that we never talk to our customers about, but it guides decision-making internally, was Four Pillars exists to elevate the craft of distilling gin. So you fast forward to March of 2014. We are 3 months into having a product on the market. December was when your wife would have received your bottle of gin. December was, and that was batch number one. It was about 400 bottles. Batch number two had gone into the trade, so into a few independent retailers, into a few great bars. But then in March, we have this critical sliding doors moment. Cameron gets an email first thing in the morning. My phone's lighting up at about 7:15 in the morning. And he's just got the news from a competition that Stuart and I didn't know he'd entered. It was the World Spirits Competition in San Francisco. It's probably one of the top three, you know, most prestigious competitions, along with the International Wine and Spirits Competition in London and the Gin Masters. And Four Pillars Rare Dry Gin had won a double gold medal. That meant that every judge in the competition had given it a gold, unanimous. I think there were 8 gins in the world that year that achieved double gold. And as well as being ecstatic about this, Stuart and I also reflected on the fact that we had no idea Cameron could make a gin that was this good. Like, I think we thought he was going to make one that was good enough and different and delicious, but he just made one of the world's best gins.
Well done.
And the sliding doors moment would have been to then look over the fence at the competitive set and go, well, right now, in gin above $70 in Australia, 80% of that market is owned by one brand. Hendrix. And they have one product. So if you can dominate, if you can sell 4 out of 5 bottles of expensive gin in Australia and only have one product in your range, and we've just made a gin that is one of the 8 best gins in the world this year, job done. Let's start marketing. Let's start selling. Let's start distributing. But you go back to purpose and you say, well, wait a minute. We said we've showed up here to elevate the craft of distilling gin. Respectfully, you don't do that by making one good gin. You do that by pushing and exploring gin. And also you do that by not doing anything else. And that's not to say that distilleries that do multiple products are bad distilleries. It's just that there is something special about pouring all of your creativity into one thing and having those constraints and going, you can't wake up one day and go, you know what, an unaged whiskey or a moonshine or a rum or a Australian take on tequila. You can't have any of those ideas because the name's on the door and it's written there in purpose. We exist to elevate the craft of distilling gin. And so really it was from there that we started to play. And then, of course, you have the now somewhat famous Christmas gin where every year we get together and we take Cameron's mum's family recipe. It's really his family tradition that his mum had 5 boys. And while his dad was watching the racing on Derby Day, she'd get all the boys into the kitchen. Out would come the Woman's Weekly 1968 Christmas recipe pullout. They would make the Christmas puddings. So Cameron gets his daughters to do that every year. And then one year he's like, all these ingredients would distill. So now we get all the kids together. We make Christmas puddings. He distills them. We age that in 100-year-old musket barrels, and that gives us our Christmas gin. So this real DNA of exploring gin and pushing flavor, making the most of this sort of bounty of flavors we have from Shiraz grapes to olive oil and olive leaves from Cobram Estate that now goes into our olive leaf gin. But I think the other little thing that's interesting to say there is that it was in late 2014, I think. So, you know, we were still only a year old. And at first we were thinking from a marketing point of view that we have this opportunity to bring people closer to the craft of making gin, that you've got this incredible bar culture in Melbourne, this growing bar culture in Sydney. You've got all these people who are incredibly passionate about gin and spirits and cocktails, and most of them have never had the chance to go to a world-class distillery. So we started inviting people to come and visit us. Originally in Warrandyte, where we were camping out at Rob Dolan's, we quickly make that decision to open Healesville and go, right, we need to go buy an old timber shed, create a permanent home for Four Pillars, a place where we can invite people. And as we did that, we realized there are other people with great flavor ideas, bartenders, chefs, other distillers. And so I think that's one of the things that's really put Four Pillars on the map, not just that experimentation that comes from within, but that willingness to open up our or Cameron's mastery of Australian botanicals and flavor and distilling to people with other ideas. And so we now make an annual distiller series, Jim, where we don't treat other distilleries as competitors. We treat them as creative collaborators. And we've made gin with Herno from Sweden and the Kyoto Distillery of Japan and Stranger and Sons from Goa in India. We've made bartender series gins. We've made gins with really interesting and different people with different ideas. And I think that's fueled, I think we're up to about 25 different gins now, and it's fueled this constant creativity and exploration of flavor.
Yeah, amazing. There's there's a lot that we've covered there. I think maybe I was trying to think what's the kind of central thing that I want to pull out, and it's like what I took away from that is, you know, you've gone from, you could be doing anything, like the world, you know, you could have got launched in any direction, you could have done any spirits, but you've honed in on a specialty and you said, this is what we're going to focus on. And you've gotten so focused on that that you've then come out the other side to all of the opportunities that are around just that specific central point. And I think that's also why you've been so creative, because if you're going to keep on pushing the boundaries around one central topic, you've got to keep pushing those boundaries. You've got to keep looking at new things.
I think that's right. And I think creativity is fueled by constraint. I think, yeah. You know, there is a certain laziness to unconstrained creativity. There is something much more interesting that emerges when creativity has only so many outlets and all those constraints are around that.
There's actually a field of thinking around that called systematic inventive thinking, which is all around that. It's like the most elegant solutions are the ones that just use what's in the present environment. And you can even use that to solve like complex engineering challenges. The great story of that is that the VW Beetle, when they were trying to make it as light and as low maintenance as possible, they decided that actually having a motor to spray the window for the window wipers was too much. And so they hooked it up to the spare tire. And so the little bit of air that's in the spare tire is actually what shot the water onto the front windscreen. And that was that, you know, use what's there, be constrained.
And I think that's really interesting. You know, we talk a bit about this notion of placing the product at the center. And that's not something that as a business you do in a one-off fashion. If that's true to the DNA of your business, then it has to remain true forever. And so almost every good idea that might appear to be a good idea that someone in the brand or marketing team could have had, almost every good idea in Four Pillars comes from Cameron and comes from the distillery, comes from production. So one of the things that I'm most proud of is that although we only make gin, we also make marmalade and chocolate and salt and relishes because we don't like to throw away flavor. And it goes back to the original gin we were making, where every batch of Rare Dry Gin would leave us with about 8 kilograms of gin steamed oranges. And Cameron's taking these home and he's making orange cakes with them, which was not a scalable business model and not good for anyone. And so he finds a local preservist and says, well, could you make this into a gin steamed orange marmalade? And so that began what has become what we call our Made from Gin program.
Hi everyone, I just wanted to jump in here to let you know if you're enjoying this episode, it doesn't need to stop here. We've taken this episode plus all the other episodes and also video footage from the interviews and made it available for free. There's also a bunch of fantastic guides, tools and resources you can use to grow your business. To grab those tools, just go to www.the-entourage.com/podcast. Right, let's get back into the show.
And all of these now are different places for that gin flavor to go and have a second life and to throw less away and to make with more. And we didn't do that because we wanted to manufacture a great gift with purchase. But guess what? At Christmas time, some gin salt or some gin chocolate or some gin marmalade on the side of a bottle of gin is a great gift with purchase. And it's a great thing to turn a bottle of gin into something more special. So the placing that product innovation, that constrained product innovation at the center, and then being good and quick at spotting opportunities to tell stories, to build experiences out, I think that's been something really special about that sort of always that craft innovation driving the brand forward.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example for you know our listeners, because I think often we see product-led businesses as being the technology businesses. San Fran-based businesses, Atlassian here, closer to home. It's like it is quite easy, I think, to think of product-led businesses that are technology, but much harder to think of, you know, actual tangible products, consumer products. And so yours is a great example. The other actually person I was thinking of as you were going through some of those examples is Renee Bunster from Bunster's Hot Sauce, who we've had on the podcast before. You know, a lot of similarities there, right? Product-led, straight-to-consumer, passionate community. She's got way more swear words being that her key product is sugar bed hot sauce.
Yeah, but at the same time, look, it's worth reflecting and yeah, shit the bed hot sauce is a good example, and Four Pillars is a good example, different in our brand DNA, but both sharing these traits that it doesn't matter how good your product is if you do not treat that product as if it's as good as you know it to be. And that taking advantage of every opportunity to tell the story, curate the story. I mean, ultimately, your brand is as strong as other people think it is, and your brand is as strong as the stories that other people tell about it. But you have to lead. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, it's no good saying this is the most crafted, attention to detail gin, but somewhere over there is a consumer in the distance. I never get the chance to tell them that. So I need to make sure that every other touch point conveys that feeling, that gives them that feeling of this is a brand that will stop at nothing to make a better product. The quality is absolutely there. As a brand guy in a product-led business, that's the role. And I think, you know, you talked about the tech sector. Although, interestingly, you're absolutely right. You couldn't find a category that is more product-led. As a result, sometimes there is an undervaluing of brand. There is a failure to realize that just because my algorithm is better, just because my UX is better, just because my core product is better, that that's enough. And I think what you and I know and what we're talking about here through the lens of Gin is it's a wonderful platform, but that alone is not enough.
Yeah, yeah. One other thing that we've certainly touched on a little bit as we go through, but I'd like to dive into just a touch deeper, is experience. Right, so I've certainly picked up on some of the experiences go around the product, like the great packaging, the surprise and delight moments. But what else do you do to really enhance the experience of people interacting with Four Pillars?
It's a really painful subject, obviously, because we are living through 2021, the experience free zone, unless that experience is through Zoom. But look, it's critical, it's central. And before we get into it, something that I just think is really interesting, knowing the audience that you have for the podcast, something that's really undervalued, I think, sometimes is thinking about what influences us as individuals. When we think about the brands and the products that we choose, what influences us? And I would argue that in this incredibly noisy, cluttered, attention deficit world that we all are navigating, the things that really move the needle for us on the brands that we love, the ones that we advocate for, the ones that we're loyal to, are great experiences. Experiences that we have had, or that people we really trust have had and have told us about so many times that we've gone and sought out that experience ourselves. And I think that's truth. And that maybe the definition of what that experience is changes depending on your category. But for us, that experience had to be the intersection of flavor, craft, and warmth, generosity, hospitality, call it what you will. In other words, once people experienced the incredible drinkability and generosity of flavor in a Four Pillars gin and a well-made gin and tonic, once we got them close up and personal to the craft of how we make the gin, ideally by getting them to come to a masterclass or a maker session where they got hands-on with botanicals and hands-on with our stills. And once they experienced that real sense of great warmth and personality, that these guys aren't just wankers, and yes, they're making great gin, but geez, they're dicks, you know. But instead, these are people who just want to open their arms and welcome people and say, look, we take our gin seriously. We don't take ourselves seriously. We're having fun. It's not rocket science. And once they experience that trifecta of things, then they would be unlikely to go back to generic, global, commercial, big gin brands that didn't have personality, didn't have a home, didn't have craft credentials. And frankly, while perfectly adequate, weren't actually particularly distinctive or delicious gins. And so that fueled a commitment to, one, events. You know, we were always built around product innovation, news creation. You know, the more new things you make, the more news you've got to tell. Social media to build community, starting with Possible and email marketing and Facebook and Instagram, and events, places where that community we're building could come together face to face. It only stood to reason we should have a distillery door where people could talk and taste and watch, and we could host masterclasses. And then the most recent experience that you touched on is Sydney. And we said, well, look, you know, Four Pillars doesn't need another another distillery. All of our gin is made in Healesville, but what we could do with is a laboratory, a place that could experiment with drinks to the same level that Healesville experiments with gin. And so that was really the genesis and the anchoring idea behind the Sydney Laboratory in Surry Hills. That there is a small still. It's actually the one named after my mum, Eileen, but she's there to do little micro batches and experimentation. But all of it anchored around that same belief that we would rather go hand to hand, one customer at a time, give them those great experiences and build a customer for life rather than rely on advertising and price promotion. Of course, we have to do some of that, but that was never going to be the heart of the brand that we wanted to build.
Yeah, that's really great. And I've definitely seen a lot of that come through firsthand. So I actually was at the Sydney Laboratory a couple of months ago, before we were in all of this state. And one thing that really shone through to me there was warmth. You mentioned that you wanted to be warmth, and 100% it was. Everyone that was there was super warm. The experience was fantastic. We were actually scheduled to do this podcast sort of way back then. So I asked one of the guys, I'm like, hey, what's some intel that I can have? And he told me that Eileen being named after your mum. He also mentioned, though, that she's Irish, a non-drinker, and has not yet been to see her namesake.
These things are true.
But I think that exemplifies everything you've been talking about. Like the crew were welcoming enough that we were in there to do a tasting, had a time for a really good chat. I said, hey, give you a little bit of intel for when I speak to Matt. And they were great guys and very happy to oblige. So I think that's everything you're trying to instill.
Look, and I think, you know, this then gets to, you know, I have lots of conversations with people in business and, you know, my background is a brand consultant, even though I'm full-time in Four Pillars, I'm always kind of nosy and curious and asking questions. And something that I see a lot of Australian businesses waver on is the importance of their Australian DNA. And, you know, we see that particularly at the moment in the tech sector where, you know, much as there's an incredible tech scene, particularly around Surry Hills, it seems, but, you know, a lot of businesses, they can't wait to become a global business. And, you know, perhaps they're going to now shift and be, you know, headquartered in the States. And my urging to people is always to make your Australianness relevant. So, you know, you look at Four Pillars, there's a lot of gin producers in the world who are exploring with great seriousness the craft of gin. But we're doing it with a bigger smile on our faces and having more fun and being warmer and more open and more inclusive, not at the expense of the quality, but we're making sure that we're balancing that seriousness of craft with something truly Australian, which is just a loving of having a drink and telling a story and sharing a yarn and all those things. And I think that's really important. I think that's a really important part of our DNA. And I think it's really important for brands to be from somewhere, not anywhere. And so I'm thrilled to hear that that's played out in your experiences. And yeah, I think that's something as a nation that we can get more confident about. And whether we're creating software or gin, we can say, what is it about the fact that we did it here in Australia that shaped something about that product, something about that experience, something about the way we go about doing what we do, our working culture, that wouldn't quite be the same anywhere else? I think we can be really proud of that.
Yeah, it also feeds into that constrained innovation that we were touching on before. Mm. All right, Matt, I've got a couple of questions here that neither of us has seen. We call it Make It Happen in a Minute. We've got five questions to move through in pretty rapid fire. You ready to get into it?
Give it a go.
All right, fantastic. Question number one, which Four Pillars gin product is your favorite and why?
Oh, I still can't go past the Rare Dry Gin. It's our original gin. It's the heartbeat of our distillery. It's actually the same gin that gets poured on top of those Shiraz gates to make Blaze Shiraz gin. It makes, I think, the most delicious gin and tonic in the world, always garnished with a slice of orange because that's what we distill it with. So Rare Dry Gin for me.
Oh, actually, you've touched on there a very controversial topic in our office when we're all together. Is it gin and tonic or gin and soda? Now, I actually am in the latter camp. But there are many, many, many in the tonic camp. Your thoughts?
Look, I like tonic because I've got a sweet tooth, and tonic does have a little bit of that sweetness as well. Stu, one of my co-founders, he loves the gin and sonic, which is a popular bartender hack. 50% tonic, 50% soda. I think we're all drifting towards those lighter, lower sugar tonics. But yeah, I like just a little bit of sweetness there, but not too much. And again, it's a gin and tonic, not a tonic and gin. So no more than three parts mixer to one part gin.
Great. Okay. Well, that's segueing into the next question nicely. What is in your favorite cocktail?
The Negroni, even parts gin, Campari, and sweet red vermouth. You can't get it wrong. Bittersweet, delicious. We make a dedicated Negroni gin, but that Rare Dry gin is a cracker in it as well. There's no better cocktail.
I'm extremely happy we're doing this on a Friday afternoon. I know what I'm segueing into. All right. Question number three. What's one thing that would surprise most people about being in politics? Now, we might have to give some background to that because we haven't touched on it.
Yeah, look, I mean, my first career was as an economist for the UK government. That didn't last too long. And then I moved into politics and speech writing and political campaigning. I don't know. I think we all, you know, whether it's watching Veep or The West Wing or The Thick of It, we have all these different perspectives. It's not as romantic as The West Wing. It's not as ridiculous as Veep. It's somewhere in between. Yeah, I kind of think all the cliches are pretty well established. But look, I had an interesting career in politics, but clearly an unsuccessful one because I worked exclusively in opposition.
Tales from the other side. All right, question number four. What's a book that has impacted you the most?
I'm going to go, I think we'll keep it relevant to this topic, and I'm going to go with a book on brand. So it was coming out of politics. My wife's Australian, and we moved to Australia in late 2005. And after tooling around, I got a job interview with a creative brand agency here in Australia. And even though I'd worked in politics, which by definition is one of the great brand challenges, like there isn't stuff that's much more tribal and primal than your political allegiance, but it wasn't language that I spoke. The language of brand and brand building was not mine. And I went to the bookshop for my interview, and I found this fantastic book by a guy called Martin Neumeyer called The Brand Gap. And it remains to this day that the best book I've read on brand and understanding, as he would put it, the gap between logic and emotion, and that recognition that the fundamental difference between a business and a brand is that introduction of that layer of emotion on top of the logic. And that's stuck with me, and I reread it frequently. Between him and the various works of Seth Godin, that's probably where most of my brand and marketing theory comes from.
Great. Yeah, The Brand Gap, I've read that, and straight away I can see that cover in my mind as well. So even done a brilliant job of branding itself. And final question is, if someone was struggling to stay focused on their business's purpose and not get distracted by noise or fads, what's the one thing they need to do to make it happen?
Wow. Let's be honest. I think an awful lot of organizations struggle with this. I think your purpose needs to live as a story you tell often internally. I think it can't become something that got printed somewhere and has become an artifact, has become almost like a museum exhibit within your business. It has to be something that lives. And the best way for purpose and strategy to live in an organization is to become part of the stories you tell. So when people are presenting ideas or when people are reporting back, you need to encourage them to tell those stories. And occasionally you can see people's eyes roll in the meeting and go, yeah, we know this, but if we stop talking about it, we will soon unknow it. So every year when I work with our marketing director and we put together our marketing plan, it always begins with our purpose and our brand strategy. It's not, we don't kind of go, well, you know all that, so we skip it, because there's always new people, there's new things going on. So I think the main thing is to define it and then to make sure it lives as stories that you tell and remains as context for decisions you make, rather than rushing past that and just interrogating things tactically.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. We're a very purpose-driven business, but I regularly catch myself and think, we haven't talked enough about it lately. You know, we've had a dozen people join since we actually all talked about this as a group and talked about why entrepreneurship is important to all of us. And I constantly catch myself and say, we should be doing it more. Well, Matt Jones, I'd love to hear your story. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. I think so much of what you've talked about and say is so important to you, I definitely see come through in the brand, and it comes through in the experiences I've had with the brand. So I think you should be really proud of what you've built.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Great chat. And you know what? That's the other way that purpose lives in your business, is find other people to talk to about it. Because the more you talk about it as a leader, the more you go, wait a minute, did that decision I make yesterday really line up with the thing that Tim and I talked about today? So that's the other thing. Just keep talking about it. So thank you for giving me the chance. It's been really fun.
Making yourself publicly accountable. Awesome. Matt, well, good luck with the weekend. I hope you get up to as much fun stuff as you possibly can. Really enjoyed talking to you. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Make It Happen show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And it doesn't need to end there. We've actually gone and grabbed a whole bunch of extra resources for you. Behind the scenes footage, videos from this and all the other episodes, as well as show notes that you can grab for free. Just head along to www.the-entourage.com/podcast and you can grab all those extra resources. Thanks for tuning in, and I cannot wait to introduce you to our next guest on the next episode.